Today's audiocast for Monday, July 17th, 2006 is made possible by Aviation Safety, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention. I'm Mike Blakeney reporting for AvWeb's Audio News Service. Diamond Aircraft announced Sunday that its D-Jet personal jet will have an introductory price of $1.38 million, or 40% more than the $850,000 named when the plane first went into development. Company officials told reporters attending the annual Diamond Fest at the company's North American headquarters in London, Ontario, Canada, that the price jump is tied closely to buyers seeking all available option packages. Among those, Diamond now intends to offer a whole plane parachute system as an option on the 315-knot five-place single-engine jet. For the price, the cockpit will come adorned with a massive glass panel display, two 12-inch PFDs, and a central 15-inch MFD. Of course, there were lots of questions about the big price hike, and company officials said it was in response to customer demand. They said most customers are ordering the planes loaded with every possible option anyway, so they might as well build them that way. The first 50 airplanes are slated for delivery by the end of 2008. Diamond also used the event to unveil a jazzed-up version of the DA-40 that might be a competitor for the likes of Cirrus, Mooney, and maybe Columbia, if you don't mind going slower with Diamond. With a PowerFlow exhaust and a new composite three-bladed Scimitar prop, Diamond's been able to coax a maximum speed of 160 knots out of the new DA-40 XL, which is about 30 knots faster than the standard DA-40, and might be enough to help future owners of high-performance singles appreciate the Diamond with its price tag of just under $330,000. The other previously mentioned airplanes are 20 or 30 knots faster, but will also cost about $150,000 more. Plus, in these fuel-conscious times, it's worth noting that the Diamond will burn about 10 gallons per hour while flying 150 knots true airspeed at 6,000 feet. Add to that the new Garmin GFC700 digital automated flight control system, which includes a flight director, altitude pre-select, GPS roll steering, over-speed protection, and two-axis autopilot all integrated with the G1000, and maybe Diamond's got a sale. There will also be an Avidyne TAS and a satellite data link system. Near the other end of the spectrum, the FAA has turned down a request by the International Cessna 120 and 140 Association to allow certain modified versions of the singles to be flown under the rules governing light sport aircraft, or LSAs. In normal configuration, the popular tail draggers have a gross weight of 1,450 pounds. That's 130 pounds heavier than the LSA maximum of 1,320 pounds. It's the only limitation the aircrafts don't naturally meet. A couple of years ago, the owners group applied for and received a supplementary type certificate that would allow owners to reduce the gross weight to 1,320 pounds in hopes that the FAA would then allow the aircraft to be flown by those with sport pilot certificates, which have much less stringent medical requirements. The FAA, however, was not so kind, according to Sport Pilot magazine. Still, by all accounts, the new category, initially spurred by the introduction of some pretty slick European airplanes, is taking off the way promoters predicted. While the majority of fixed-wing LSAs certified in the U.S. still arrive from overseas, American companies are catching up. As we've previously reported, Cessna will unveil its concept for an LSA next week at the EAA AirVenture, and some of the better-known U.S. kit builders are getting into the act. Cub Crafters recently got FAA approval for its Sport Cub, and Rands Aviation, which was a pioneer in light aircraft manufacturing in the 1980s, is also reportedly planning an all-metal factory-built LSA. The country's third-largest fly-in, EAA's Northwest Fly-In in Arlington, Washington, is now raising money to build a permanent sport aviation park at the field, and Pilot Journey has added a sport pilot section to its website, complete with a $99 introductory flight offer. Not bad for an upstart industry. Groups representing cargo pilots are calling on the FAA to give fire safety the same priority on cargo aircraft as in passenger planes. During a two-day hearing into the fire that destroyed a UPS DC-8 just after it landed in Philadelphia last February, Shannon Gibson, a UPS pilot and official with the Independent Pilots Association, the union representing UPS pilots, said cargo aircraft should have mandatory fire suppression systems like those in passenger planes. There are double standards, Gibson told the hearings. The Airline Pilots Association joined the call for better training for airport firefighters for cargo aircraft fires. Firefighters took more than 4 hours to douse the flames, which may have started 25 minutes before the aircraft landed. The crew was 4 minutes out before the smoke alarm sounded and didn't have much time to spare in getting out of the burning plane. Although UPS has so far declined to confirm just what was on board that DC-8, the NTSB probe is looking at whether lithium-ion batteries of the type used to power laptop computers might have caused the fire. Although problems are statistically rare, they can have spectacular results. An exploding cell phone battery is blamed for causing $100,000 in damage to a California home last year. And 2 years ago, the FAA banned non-rechargeable lithium batteries as cargo on passenger planes because it found that halon, the fire suppressant used in jetliners, couldn't put out a lithium fire. Meanwhile, the NTSB says that earlier fixes aimed at preventing sparks from igniting vapors in aircraft fuel tanks don't work. In a news release last week, the board said that the wing tank of a Transmeal Boeing 727 exploded, even though it had been properly fitted with electrical shields designed to prevent the electrical arcing that most likely ignited the vapors. An airworthiness directive required the wiring harness in question to be inspected, repaired, and then wrapped in plastic before being returned to the conduit in the wing tank. The board concluded the accident illustrates that ignition sources continue to exist and fuel tank explosions continue to occur in both wing and center fuel tanks despite the corrective efforts of government regulators and industry. The accident happened while the plane was on the ground at Bangalore, India, and no one was hurt, but the blast wrecked the wing and the plane would have crashed had it been airborne, the NTSB said. Both AOPA and EAA are lobbying Congress to exempt aviation gasoline from two proposed amendments to the Clean Air Act. The bills propose making mandatory for all motor vehicle gasolines, with the exception of a few collector cars, to contain at least 10% renewable fuels by the year 2010. About the only viable alternative fuel now available is ethanol fermented from corn, and it gives airplanes a major hangover. Separate studies by EAA, the FAA, and Cessna have conclusively determined that ethanol damages everything from engines to fuel systems in airplanes, but the bills, with their current wording, would also require the 10% quota for avgas. In addition to exempting avgas, the groups want Congress to allow premium automotive fuel to be made without ethanol, thereby providing an option for aircraft flown with automotive fuel STCs. The co-pilot of the Challenger business jet that crashed at Montrose, Colorado in 2004, killing Teddy Ebersol, the youngest son of NBC sports head Dick Ebersol, and two others, says the manuals for the jet should have been more specific about the dangers of flying the Canadair Challenger 601 in icing conditions. Eric Sloan Wixell of Daytona Beach claims the flight and training manuals for the plane should have spelled out the icing dangers more explicitly. The NTSB concluded that the crash, which occurred on takeoff, was most likely caused by the pilot failing to manually check for ice contamination on the wings. The pilot and flight attendant were killed, while Ebersol, his older son Charlie, and Wixell were injured. Boeing engineers say its 787 Dreamliner is gaining weight as they figure out ways to shed the enormous shock a lightning strike would bring to the airliner's nearly all-composite airframe. Lightning strikes one or two airliners every year, and although shocking to some, it's not normally a big deal. The big charge just passes through the very conductive aluminum. But in a mostly composite airplane like the Dreamliner, the enormous charge looks for a relatively few conductive paths, such as hinges, attachment points, and wiring, and it can vaporize or fuse them. The answer is to provide conductive routes through the composite, and that's where the weight gain comes in for the efficiency-driven design, according to a report in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Metal strips or mesh can be added to the layers of composite to ensure the electricity has a place to go. That has pushed the airliner 2.5% beyond its target weight, although Boeing officials insist the plane will not weigh more than what was promised customers. Northrop Grumman says it has developed a laser-based system, a laser bubble, that can knock just about any kind of airborne threat out of the air within a 5-mile radius of an airport and is effective against shoulder-fired missiles up to 20 miles away. Once it starts selling the system in quantity, Northrop predicts a fully installed system would price out about $30 million. The company claims its system will be popular at airports in countries that are having neighborhood disputes, such as South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and Israel, of course. The first systems might cost as much as $200 million and will be available in about 18 months. Company officials say the laser bubble will destroy rockets, mortars, artillery shells, unmanned aerial vehicles, short-range ballistic missiles, as well as cruise missiles, according to the Reuters story. Hopefully, it'll be easy not to look like one of those things. And that leads us to, once again, our final story and a reminder that AirVenture Oshkosh is just around the corner. AvWeb always pulls out all the stops for its coverage of AirVenture, and this year we've added a new dimension to our coverage. In addition to our four complete AvWeb Flash and Newswire editions from Oshkosh, Monday, July 24th, Wednesday, July 26th, Friday, July 28th, and our wrap-up on Monday, July 31st, we're producing three in-depth podcasts, Tuesday, July 25th, Thursday, July 27th, and Saturday, July 29th. And expect work to continue on our updated avweb.com homepage. Please offer your patience and comments as our new home comes alive. Find all these stories and more online today at avweb.com. Comments on this podcast welcome. Email us at audionews@avweb.com. This report was brought to you by Aviation Safety, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention. For more information, click on the AudioCast sponsors link. Look for AvWeb's next AudioCast on Friday, July 21st. I'm Mike Blakeney. Thanks for downloading AvWeb's Audio News.